Good evening.
Good evening.
A new face tonight. Welcome. Did you hear about us on the internet?
Through a friend.
Through a friend.
I used to go to the Sanaku's temple a lot.
Ah, with Kokyo?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice.
I just moved into the area not that long ago.
I see. Well, are you living now in San Jose?
Mountain View.
Mountain View. Yeah. Can't get to Santa Cruz very easily anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the same position. I miss it very much.
Yeah.
Let's do introductions around.
Cardinal. Wendy.
Leslie.
Michelle.
Samuel.
Marie.
Jeffrey.
Nico.
Yeah.
Ron.
Angie. So we're studying the Platform Sutra. We're in the beginning of it, really. We've just the first few chapters. First, the history of himself, briefly, and then sort of basic Buddhist teachings. And then he plunges into his own way of approaching Buddhism, which is a very much more ordinary, maybe ordinary isn't the right word, but much more connected to how people just live on the ground in the world, rather than proposing something a little elevated. It isn't so elevated. In fact, it goes right straight to the heart. The chapter that we have now, if I can find it, is about one of the basics of the most basic of our lineage. My book is falling apart. It's about the Bodhisattva vows, which we recite at the end of every meeting, which we recite often day and night as a way of staying focused, as a way of staying in touch with the true meaning of what we're doing. So we talked about no thought and no form, and we talked about that last week. To be externally free of all forms, just be free of forms, and the body of your nature is perfectly pure. We take no form as our body. Said in the school of Dharma, when we practice Zen, we don't contemplate the mind and we don't contemplate purity. We don't talk about being dispassionate. We're not trying to be a particular way. We don't have to have a particular kind of mind. Sometimes we think of spiritual people as being sort of sublime in some way. But that's not what he's pointing to. He's talking about the truth of the mind, the actual reality of our experience. If someone says to contemplate purity, your nature is already pure because of deluded thoughts, that reality is obscured. So we generate thinking all the time, and we begin to believe our thoughts as true things. Thoughts are just thoughts. It's Some of them are very beautiful. Some of them are very meaningful. Some of them are really stupid and idiotic and ridiculous. They just keep running through our mind all the time. And we're always looking for the meaning of things and the truth of things. But we get very, very attached to how we think. And as we know now, at this point in our history, there is a tremendous amount of attachment to ideas and opinions. And it's creating a tremendous sense of suffering. We can feel it all around us. As if the thoughts were real. And as if under the thoughts there weren't some purity in each one of the ones who is thinking. So Weinen goes on. To talk about the Dharma, the bodies of Buddha, the transformation body, the Dharma body, the Nirmanakaya body, and then goes on to say, good friends, having taken refuge in the three-bodied Buddha, let us now make four boundless vows. Recite after me, I vow to save all beings, no matter how numberless. I vow to end all afflictions, no matter how countless. I vow to master all teachings, no matter how limitless. I vow to attain Buddhahood, no matter how transcendent. He says, now recite this three times. He says, as for I vow to save all beings, no matter how numberless, it isn't Weinen who does the saving. Good friends, every being you can think of saves themselves with their own nature in their own bodies. Isn't this a relief? We chant this every time and people get so head up about it because how can I save anybody? And how are we going to be so high and mighty that we're going to save all sentient beings? That's ridiculous. But Sui Neng is saying, I vow to save the sentient beings of my mind. I vow to pay attention to my thought about what I meet in my life and world. What does it mean? They save themselves with their own nature, he asks. The wrong views and afflictions, ignorance and delusions in their own material bodies already possess the nature of original enlightenment. It is just this nature of original enlightenment that saves them with right views. So it's how we see things. And that's crucial. We can think things till the cows come home, but if we don't have a clear view of things, we get lost. We get lost in our thoughts. We get lost in the city. We need a very clear view of our own working mind working and of other people's minds working, how things are laid out. Once they realize, the ones who are full of afflictions and ignorance, once they realize the prajna wisdom of right views, they dispel their ignorance and delusion, and each being saves themselves. The false are saved with truth. The deluded are saved with awareness. The ignorant are saved with wisdom. The bad are saved with goodness, and the afflicted are saved with enlightenment. Those who are saved like this are truly saved. As for I vow to end all afflictions, no matter how countless, this means to get rid of all the delusions of your own mind. And I vow to master all teachings, no matter how limitless, means to study the true unexcelled Dharma. And I vow to attain Buddhahood, no matter how transcendent, means always to practice with humility and respect all beings, to avoid attachments, to give rise to prajna from your own awareness, and put an end to delusions. It's through self-realization that Buddhahood is attained. This is the power of making vows. This whole thing of vowing is so crucial to our practice. Koven said, a vow is not a promise. We take vows. We take vows to when we get married, to honor and respect as we get married. We take vows when we become citizens to protect our country. We vow a lot. It's not a promise. As Koven says, it's creating an objective for which we offer our whole effort entirely. So when we vow, in this little four-line gatha, Koben's example are that if we're at a door, a very narrow door, and there are two of us, we let one through first. If we're in the desert, and there's just enough water for one, and there are two of us, you leave the water with the one. In other words, you vow to realize that the one you are with is the same as you, and allow and accept and let that live. So Koven's translation is, sentient beings are infinite, they will save themselves. Desires are infinite, they will reach an end by themselves. Dharmas are infinite, so there is learning and study. Buddha's way is no above, so it is always accomplished or allowed. He says it's like sweeping fallen leaves. You sweep and sweep, and it gets all clean, and poof, they're back down again. Over and over and over. Or it's like waves, and I often think of waves if I'm not sleeping at night. I think, oh, the waves I saw 5 days ago, they're still doing it. They're doing it any hour of the day or night that you think of them. It's happening over and over and over. It all lives on. So Red Pine said, by vowing to save all beings, we create the same realization body created by all Buddhas. By vowing to end all afflictions, we end our attachment to our material body, just as all Buddhas have freed themselves of theirs. By vowing to master all teachings, we produce the transformation body, just as all Buddhas have done in their effort to transmit this teaching to others. And by vowing to attain Buddhahood, we end our separation from our Dharma body which is the original nature of all beings, not only of Buddhas. In other words, he's saying it's right here. It's in you and in me. It's in Donald Trump. So we do this bowing before we get up and go out into the world. So it's very helpful to remember that we end with this, because this is our way of going out the door and letting others go first. It is not a simple practice. It's a bodhisattva practice, but I always have to say it doesn't mean that we just lie down and let people walk on us at all. Sometimes people don't realize how deluded they are. And if we have an opportunity to be with someone deluded, we can protect ourselves. I've been having that experience off and on with, I have a lot of construction going on in my house. And so all these great big men are in charge of the construction. And they're in and out of the house all the time, and they have their ideas about how things are supposed to be. And sometimes they forget me, or forget who I am, and sort of walk all over me. And I've been sort of exercising a kind of bodhisattva assertiveness, you could say, of just standing up and saying, now remember, I'm old and disabled and I live all alone and you have to take care of me. Oh, they say, oh, yes. Oh, yes, I respect you so much. But they've been roaring at me. You know? So it's really important to be clear and help people be clear. Because we keep running into our own cloudiness, into each other's cloudiness, and we help each other this way. So it's a loving kind of way to be. But it's a strict kind of careful view of how we can be with others. I took out the Save All Sentient Beings, as you notice, when we chant this bodhisattva vow. We vow to be with all things. With all things, because who knows? You know, if a rock is sentient, or a star is sentient, or seems like it all is filled with mind. The same mind, the same amazing consciousness, which is so mysterious. So the vow to say, be with all things, just allows this same allowing that Koban was talking about. That's the Buddha way. But to allow it, and be strong. We need to be very strong. That's part of our practice. That's part of the bodhisattva practice, is to be very, very strong. Red Pine says, Buddhas are simply those beings who who see things as they really are. And that sounds like some sort of woo-woo thing. Oh, it's kind of, you know, magical and everything is transparent and glowing with light or something. But no, it's just seeing things as they are. And of course, there are many levels to that. The more we slow down, the more we see. As you know, even in science, there's the famous story of William James and going to Harvard and asking to study science with a famous biologist who set him to test by giving him a fish and asking him to write down everything that he noticed about the fish and bring it to him at the end of the day. And he wrote and wrote and wrote. He studied and studied the fish. And he brought it to the teacher, and the teacher said, "Oh, that's really good. Now come back tomorrow." And he did the fish for a whole week. And then the teacher said, you see, you never get to the end of the fish. You never, ever know everything about it. But the more we look, the more we see. And the more we see, the more we understand. And the more we understand, the more connected we feel. That's how we feel our connection. So there's time for questions. I think we'll stop there. He goes on to repentance. So this is all part of the whole little ceremony that we do of precepts, taking the precepts, we call it, which starts with actually repentance and then goes on to the bodhisattva vows, or taking refuge actually, and then goes on to the pure precepts and then the prohibitory precepts. But he's carefully offering these things, taking refuge. So I think I'll stop there, assuming you all have something to say too, I hope. Jeffrey?
Angie, somewhere he talks about the 84,000 ways to wisdom, describing it because there's 84,000 afflictions.
Yes.
I mean, there's so many things that we're deluded about, and so the practice. I was thinking about raking leaves. You must live on my block.
Just and, two blocks over.
And it's that time of the year, and I'm a great rake leaver. I love to rake leaves. Yeah. So, and I've been doing that since my childhood. I love to rake leaves. But yeah, there's so many things to learn from raking a leaf and watching the leaves fall from trees. The autumnal experience, especially in terms of our practice, because it's ongoing. You know, really see it as a metaphor for our practice.
Gate.
And if you don't rake the leaves, you should see what happens to that street or the lawn or the things that are trying to grow. But I just really found that 84,000 ways to wisdom, because we have 84,000 yeah. illusions and afflictions, to be so perfectly put.
It's probably more.
It's a metaphor for how big something is.
Yes.
Exactly. One of the things when we started this out, you were asking, you once punctuated something I had said. I was kind of amazed about this man who was illiterate. And you were punctuating with, isn't that refreshing, and isn't that, you know, isn't like, he's really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And as we go through the Platform Sutra, I'm once again just so impressed with this lineage and this voice that we're hearing from so long ago, and how it applies right today and right now and right in my practice.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
That is really cool. Ryan?
I wanted to ask a contrarian question. What about the leaf blower? Does the leaf blower have Buddha mind, or does the gardener who's waving away with it? He probably does. He just can't hear it.
What happens to your mind when you hear it?
Oh, God. Well, I like my gardener. I really like it. I never had a gardener for years. I always did everything, like Jeffrey. And I love breaking leaves, but now I have a gardener. But I don't like the noise. But I like the gardener because he's really a good guy. And he loves to do his job, although he's a little careless and breaks my dahlias. But, you know, that's his practice. Really? So, you know, part of the whole thing is don't insist on fixed ideas.
Yes, don't get attached.
It's all relative
it
to
is.
Something. And I've been working that too. And breaking leaves is a really good way.
I
like the sweep the olives off my patio every morning because they fall, you know. That's sweeping. I would never use a leaf blower. Thank you.
I'm not sure it has to do with this particular session, but a few weeks ago when you were talking about, I think what Kogan said about practicing Zen and meditation isn't to rid your mind of thoughts, but to not be attached. And that's been tremendously helpful to me lately. Just tremendously helpful, because I think, though Vaughn would talk about not getting rid of, you know, that
mm-hmm.
to try to get rid of was not the way.
Yes.
There was, you added something for me, and I wanted to say thank you, because the part about not being attached lets me somehow just kind of let them float a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they're not there, but, you know, that I really can say, oh,
yeah, hello.
You are again, old friend.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes they're good thoughts and useful ones or creative ones. It's not that we have to throw them all away either. Just that we don't need to get caught up by them.
Yeah.
At least not for more than we need to.
Yeah. Yeah. Pardon me, but it just occurs to me, if we're not being attached to either positive or negative thoughts, then how can we
think more of one and less of another. I mean,
by cultivating the ones that are good, that are useful and helpful and loving and kind.
What's the difference between cultivating and being attached?
It's a good question. There's a huge difference, because being attached means we have to have it, and we have to never let it go, even though it goes. So it's like our breath. When we lose our connection with the breath, we come back to it. When we lose our connection to our goodness, we just come back to it. It's not being attached to it. It's just allowing it, allowing what's already here not to become obscured. Actually, the afflictions are on a different, have a different standard from what's positive in us. It's hard to say, but the negative is an imposition on the positive. And the negative isn't real in the same way that the positive is. So that we come back to it. Tanya?
When you were talking about vows, in my mind, the word dedication came to my mind. Is it similar to,
yes,
like, I dedicate my life to this?
Yes.
Whatever you want to call it, practice or...
Yes.
Liking Trump and hoping or whatever. I know you don't like the word hope, but... but in this matter, maybe we can...
Yes, we can.
So going back to dedicating, can we use that?
Yes. Yes. Good. A friend of mine is writing a book on hope and trying to find a way for it to be expressed in the paramitas in a Buddhist kind of way. Because you're right, hope is kind of a no-no in our way of understanding how things work. But there is some kind, and I think it has to do with this vowing and this dedication that we make to our intention to benefit and find a wholesome way. Yeah. Yeah.
Very good. I like the word.
Yeah, I do too.
From a good, it works for me.
Yeah.
But I mean, I also see what you're saying about the fault foundation for housing.
Well, if we build all of our aspirations on hope, it posits disappointment. It's built into it, like war is, you know, and peace or black and white create each other, and hope and disappointment do too. I think that's why we.
Right. Yeah.
So if you don't expect to be disappointed, then you can be surprised. That's much more fun.
You wrote the book.
Now it's 8:00.
I like a lot of things. You never know what will happen.
That's exactly right.
It will turn out all right. Probably.
Not necessarily.
Well, no, it will be okay as it is. But the challenge is, how do we...
Accept it.
Accept it.